Today on Against the Grain, Bernie Sanders, the self-styled Democratic socialist from Vermont, catalyzed the discontent of many Americans with economic inequality and injustice, and with the mainstream of the Democratic Party, which has presided over neoliberalism. But Jeffrey Sinclair argues, Sanders not only butted up against the formidable Clinton machine, but was hobbled by his own political baggage. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with the co-editor of Counterpunch about the future of social movements after Sanders and in the age of Trump. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Since Donald Trump was elected president, many on the left have wondered out loud whether Bernie Sanders would have won more decisively against him than Hillary Clinton. Others have uttered their relief that it wasn't Sanders who lost to Trump, as the left would have been blamed for Trump's presidency for a generation. Jeffrey Sinclair, co-editor of Counterpunch, followed every twist and turn of the Sanders campaign. His postmortem, Bernie and the Sandinistas, Field Notes from a Failed Revolution, looks at Sanders, the base of his supporters, and whether the Democratic Party can be the staging ground for a renewed left. Given the battles to come with Trump, these questions seem especially pertinent. Jeffrey, looking in hindsight, do you think it was a lost cause to run on the leftward side of the Democratic Party as Sanders did?
I don't think it was a lost cause. I don't think Sanders had any chance of winning the nomination. And I assume that he knew that when he entered the primaries. So the question then becomes, you know, what was his objective? And did he succeed? If the objective was to catalyze a movement around a political campaign, which I think is a perfectly rational objective, then I think that he succeeded probably beyond his, you know, wildest dreams. I do think that something maybe happened, you know, in the beginning of the campaign, which was maybe Sanders becoming somewhat intoxicated on his own poll numbers and, you know, maybe became entranced with the idea that he just might win this thing. And I think that he, if that happened to him, I don't know. But he certainly, that certainly did, that sense of a kind of the euphoria of possibility, I think did infect his movement, which I dubbed the Sandinistas. And I think, in a way, that kind of delusion undercut is that organizing a little bit. Maybe that remains to be seen.
To what degree do you think he was committed to trying to create a broader movement before the intoxication set in?
I don't think he created a movement. I think that he catalyzed it, or movements that had been percolating, and more than percolating in many cases, gravitated toward him. So he became a kind of a center of gravity for a lot of political movements that had been at work in Obama time that maybe a lot of people hadn't paid any attention to because, you know, I mean, what's to protest, you know, with Obama, right? He's great. Huh? And so you had the minimum wage movement was one, and obviously the remains of the Occupy movement. Those were there, and I think that they became a rallying force for Sanders. What he wasn't able to do, tragically, I think, was to really form a relationship with the Black Lives Matter movement. In fact, he stumbled out of the gate. I think we'll all remember that moment when he was confronted by Black Lives Matter protesters early on in the campaign and just stood there mute, really had no response to their critique. I don't know if that was fatal or not, but it certainly hobbled his ability to expand the movement outside of sort of nexus of white college students?
Well, I'd like to talk more as we go on about his supporters, but before we get to that, what was he up against in going up against Clinton? And I mean, in a broad sense, since, as you're saying, the ultimate goal wasn't necessarily to become the candidate for the Democratic Party.
Well, he was up against an institution, really the house that the Clintons built, which is a party of neoliberals with deep ties to Wall Street, with deep ties to defense contractors, and the corporate world. It was, you know, the origins of this go all the way back to really the mid-'80s with the creation of the Democratic Leadership Council, which Al Gore and Joseph Lieberman and Bill Clinton were founding members of. And basically, they wanted to take the party away from the McGovern wing, right? Not that the McGovern wing ever really controlled the Democratic Party, but they wanted to stamp out that old liberalism of the Great Society and even the New Deal and replace it with something that was more corporate friendly. And they succeeded, certainly with the election of Bill Clinton, and they wiped out really the old infrastructure of the DNC and replaced it with their people. And it became essentially a money-raising operation, shaking down, you know, Goldman Sachs and Citibank and Lockheed, all the big corporations, and sort of purging a lot of the union activists, a lot of the environmental activists, the social justice and economic justice activists who'd been inside the leadership of the Democratic Party. And it has continued that way for, you know, 25 years. I think one of Obama's greatest failings, to the extent that he is somewhat less of a neoliberal than the Clinton, is that he did not reshape the DNC in his own image. He kind of left the Clinton people in charge of it. And so by the time Hillary's running again in 2016, she has complete control over the apparatus of the party.
How much of the support that Sanders got do you think was for him, and how much do you think was, in essence, a reaction to Clinton? You know, that this was the alternative to the neoliberalism of Clinton, what she represented, her hawkishness, and so on.
I don't know if you could break it down in percentage, but I would say that a great deal of it was a reaction against Clinton. Many of the Obama people really still had bitter feelings over the way the Clintons had run a race-baiting campaign against Obama in 2008. I think that the anti-interventionist left really viewed Clinton as, and her whole operation from Samantha Power and Victoria Nuland, as dragging Obama into certainly the Libyan conflict and having, you know, a very hawkish attitude toward Syria, Iran, very provocative toward Russia, and sort of central to, you know, what became known as the Asian pivot and a much more belligerent attitude toward China. Now, Sanders, I think one of his failings was that he did not talk very much about foreign policy in the campaign and didn't completely capitalize on that growing resentment on the progressive wing of the party and independents as well, and Greens, on Hillary's really ultra-hawkish and belligerent foreign policy.
Right. Well, the question of that I asked you before about to what degree were people supporting Sanders and to what degree were they opposing Clinton by supporting Sanders is relevant here, too, because I think for a lot of people, the assumption that they made in terms of supporting Sanders was that he was not the hawk that Clinton was. And as you say, she was especially hawkish. But his history, his track record has not been fantastic on that question.
No, he was effectively neutralized by his own record. You know, you go back to when Sanders was first in the Congress, he, you know, at that time, you know, calling himself an independent socialist from Vermont, you know, one of his first major votes was to endorse the bombing of an independent socialist country, Yugoslavia. And this so outraged many of his staffers that several of his top staffers resigned. I go over this in the book, a few people remember that Sanders, even though he attacked Hillary for voting for the Iraq War during Bush time, just a few years earlier, in fact, it would have been, 3 years earlier, I think, he voted three times to endorse the really genocidal sanction regime that the Clinton administration had imposed on Iraq, which killed more than 500,000 Iraqi kids, voted three times to endorse that, and voted twice for regime change in Iraq under Clinton. Now, his policy changed, you know, his position changed under Bush, but, you know, he had voted for regime change at least twice in Iraq. His policy on Libya was also one of regime change. So he couldn't effectively counter Hillary's foreign policy. And, you know, he could have said, you know, well, I made a mistake on these, and, you know, the evidence is clear that this kind of reckless interventionism has blown up in our face, but he chose not to.
What about Israel? Tell us about his track record there.
Well, I think he's been as devoted as almost every other Democrat to the state of Israel. And, you know, that's really the price of the ticket that all Democrats seem to pay. I mean, there have been a few who've gone astray, like Cynthia McKinney, but they've paid the ultimate price. So there was really no breathing space between Hillary and Sanders on Israel and the Palestinians.
Jeffrey Sinclair is my guest. He is co-editor of Counterpunch and author of Bernie and the Sandernistas, the programs Against the Grain, and I'm Sasha Lilly. One of the themes of, if we can call it that, of the election season that has now come to an end was that in Trump and in Bernie Sanders, there was something in common in some way that they were twins. Now, that, of course, is often a very easy trope, the media especially saying the left and the right resemble each other. But to what degree do you feel like Trump and Sanders drew on some of the same impulses in terms of their support?
Well, I think that that Trump certainly began to mime many of Bernie's themes. I don't think Trump was particularly anti-free trade, but he saw the appeal that Sanders was making to white working class, blue-collar voters on the trade issue. And there's no doubt that that has been fermenting, you know, deeply in the Republican Party since at least the, you know, Buchanan campaign. And Trump was really the first Republican candidate I can think of, other than Buchanan, and maybe to some extent Mike Huckabee in populist mode, was actually talking to those, I guess we would call them the Reagan Democrats. I think they're fully Republicanized now and weaponized as such. But Trump was really the first one to talk to them on economic issues rather than on these, you know, social issues that the Republicans have thrown to them over the decades. And in that sense, you know, I think that they were sort of speaking in similar language to similar demographics. But I don't think Trump meant any of it, as you can tell from, you know, the billionaires that he's stocking his cabinet with. And it's multi-billionaires. I mean, the poor guy who's just been nominated to be Secretary of the Army, you know, it's worth $1.8 billion, which used to mean something, but now it only gets you this sort of sub-cabinet post as Secretary of the Army. You have to be a multi-billionaire, you know, to get a plum position, I guess.
Right, like Secretary of State. So one of the things that one can see, though, as a parallel, and on top of what you're just mentioning in terms of appealing to these social issues, another thing that Trump and Sanders both seem to draw from in different ways is on the past. Politicians obviously often do this, but, you know, and the power of nostalgia is very strong. Trump's shtick was make America great again, because obviously it used to be and isn't now. And in a way, actually, Sanders, without using that same language, also offered a return to the past.
I agree with that. In fact, you know, I sort of closed the book with the sort of reverie of Sanders. And he's appealing to a different past, right? He's appealing to a past when America thought of itself as good, as empathetic, as caring. The past represented by the New Deal, by the Great Society. And I think that's a comforting notion, but it's also limiting, because it's not speaking toward the future. And I think maybe one of Sanders' greatest failings as a politician was that he was gifted at delivering his own message, almost in a kind of professorial way. But I don't think that he was listening very much to this incredible, energetic movement of largely young people. I mean, he spoke to some of their concerns, such as student loans, but still, I think that his core program, the template for his talks, remained encased in a kind of amber, you know, looking back toward maybe the 40s, the Democratic Party in the 40s.
You mentioned earlier that Sanders missed an opportunity, owing to his own track record, to go after Clinton from the left around foreign policy and bellicosity and so on. And what was interesting was that Trump seemed to, in the same way that perhaps you were mentioning that Trump seemed to be watching how Sanders was appealing to people based on these economic questions, in some ways it seemed like Trump pulled on some of the kind of anti-war rhetoric that we associate with the left, that the left candidate really didn't rise to the challenge to do. And of course, in terms of the practice, what we'll see clearly with Trump is going to be another thing altogether. But there was this harnessing of that anti-interventionist critique that has long been the domain of the left.
It has. And, you know, Trump was very explicit. I mean, in ways that I think no Democratic candidate, certainly in my memory, has been in a frontal attack on NATO. We just haven't heard that from very many Democrats. I don't even know that, you know, somebody like Dennis Kucinich went that far. And again, hammering over and over on the catastrophe of the Iraq War in much more explicit terms than Sanders did. And really, the Democrats could only respond by, you know, dredging up, you know, some quotes that he made seeming to endorse the war on a Howard Stern show, right? But since that time, he had absolutely, you know, repudiated those quotes and denounced the war in really unambiguous terms, something that certainly Clinton never did. You know, she lives in the sort of in the shadows of ambiguity, right? Nothing ever very explicit out of her mouth. And certainly that was appealing to anti-interventionists. I don't know that it captured many of Sanders' voters. You know, I don't know how deeply you can sort of drill down into the demographics of this election now that so much trash about, you know, Russian hacking and misogyny and all this other excuses have been put forward by the Clinton people. But it certainly there is an anti-interventionist libertarian movement in the country that I think Trump did tap into that maybe undercut the appeal that Gary Johnson and the libertarians might have had otherwise in this election. And I think that Johnson's, you'd have to say, a really poor showing given the opportunities for the libertarians maybe resulted from that, that these anti-war libertarians ended up voting for Trump because of, you know, he had really hit hard on those issues.
One of Trump's strengths you point to kind of illustrate a deficiency on Bernie Sanders' part, and that was around his charisma. Now, of course, the mainstream media sees Trump as just a buffoon and can't sort of strip away the layers of his appeal. But you write in a great phrase in your book that Trump emits pheromones of doom. Can you tell us what you mean by that and how it contrasts to the lack of pheromones of any kind, I guess, emanating from Sanders or Clinton?
Yeah, I think that he just does. There's something about Trump, and he doesn't speak in complete sentences. He's unlike any public speaker or political figure, I think, that we've ever seen, certainly in my lifetime. But I went to see him down in when he appeared in Eugene. This was early on in the campaign. And, you know, here we are. I mean, Eugene is, you know, maybe even beyond the socialist republic, you know, as they used to refer to Ann Arbor. And Trump went right in to this, you know, maybe the most self-consciously, you know, progressive city, certainly in the Northwest, if not the country. And he was just electrifying. And he seemed to both feed on and feed at the same time this sense of doom and anger and despair that maybe was even subconscious in some of his audience, and just sort of bring it to the surface. And the event was just electrifying. You can see why, you know, fights were breaking out at a Trump event. It was like a World Wrestling Federation, you know, match. It was wild. But, you know, driving back up to Portland, when I was, you know, trying to remember what it was exactly that Trump had said, I couldn't remember one quote. But, you know, there was just this something that was emanating from his presence that was, you know, certainly thrilled the crowd. And it was undetected by the media, as you said. I mean, they, if anything, the main, you know, his trampling of all the expectations of the mainstream media, you know, certainly for a lot of us must provide a little bit of schadenfreude. because the entire elite establishment was just steamrolled by it. Now, we're definitely going to pay the price for that.
Right, but in some ways continue to be in the sense that it seems that much of the mainstream media can't drill down into what is the sort of driving forces within this person. A lot of the analysis that you get is purely psychological. And while his appointments may be pointing the way to where he's going, you know, a simply psychological analysis of any political figure is just not going to be enough.
No, it's not going to be enough. And so far, the kind of resistance that the Democrats have offered has been really, it's just pathetic. I must say I'm completely mystified by even many of the progressives, such as Michael Moore, the time that they devoted to this, the Hamilton electors, is that what, you know, they were calling them, this, you know,
the electoral college challenge,
yeah, seems completely wasted to me. If I were them, and I'm glad I'm not, but if I were them, what I would have used this opportunity to clean house at the DNC and to completely wage an internal war against the leadership of the Democratic Party. And instead, what you've got is a rationalization of defeat, and you have promoted the same leaders back into the same positions. You know, Nancy Pelosi, Charles Schumer. Now, you know, here is a question to ask Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has joined the leadership team of the Democrats in the Senate, where his boss is Charles Schumer, the senator from Citibank. I find that just really hard to process. And it seems to me it's a really wasted opportunity to take this period in the interregnum and not radically reshape the Democratic Party, and instead focus on this fool's errand of somehow stopping Trump in the Electoral College, which is an institution that many of the people leading this campaign believe correctly is undemocratic and racist in its roots.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Jeffrey Sinclair, the co-editor of Counterpunch, about his book, Bernie and the Sandinistas, Field Notes from a Failed Revolution, that's published by Counterpunch, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org, and my name is Sasha Lilly. So the Democratic Party, in the wake of Trump's victory in the Electoral College, have been pointing to all sorts of things, as you've indicated, Russian hacking, various reasons not to sort of look within and look at Clinton's failure to garner wider support. Instead, of course, the focus was on these different external factors that sabotage things. One of the interesting things, of course, is there's been a lot of attention to the idea of whether it's a hack or they were leaks, these emails that were embarrassing to Clinton that came out before the election. And of course, one of them, or a series of them, had to do with the bias that was proved by these emails of the Democratic National Committee against Sanders, which never seems to be mentioned now, and hardly was then. You know, the scandal at the time wasn't that there was clear stated bias against Bernie Sanders, but that there was outside interference in American politics.
Right. And I think that Bernie really kind of dropped the ball on this himself, because he could have he had them over a barrel, I think. He wasn't going to win, but he had explicit evidence that they had conspired to rig the primaries against him. And he should have used that to force a complete overhaul of the DNC and the party. And instead, what we get, and this just seems completely outrageous to me, one of the co-conspirators, Donna Brazile, replaces the chief conspirator, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, to become the new leader of the DNC. And
Donna Brazile, of course, was working for CNN and was exposed for giving questions in advance to the Clinton campaign.
Leaking questions to the Clinton campaign. Just absolutely outrageous, you know, A, as a, quote, journalist, and B, as a member of the party, you know, helping to rig, you know, your own elections. And she's been particularly shameless in the aftermath of the election. She's one of the leading voices blaming all of this on Russian hacking and interference. But one thing that we know is that whatever the provenance of the leaks or the hacks of the DNC emails, they're not fake news. This is what the leadership of the party really thought. And they seem to believe, I don't think it's true necessarily, but they seem to believe that that information doomed their election. So what are the Democrats going to do? Are they going to change their leaders? No. Are they going to change what their leaders think? I don't think so. Are they going to learn to lie better? Or are they going to get better cybersecurity? I think it's probably, you know, option D there.
Well, but is it realistic to expect that coming out of this, Clinton's defeat, even though she did win the popular vote, is it really reasonable to expect that the Democratic Party is going to look within and change itself? You write in Bernie and the Sandinistas that there have been other, quote, left insurgencies in the past, challenges from the left, Jesse Jackson, Dennis Kucinich, that didn't move the Democratic Party to the left at all in their wake. So is it reasonable to expect that that might happen, or is there something so institutionally fixed about the Democratic Party and its relationship to its leftward side, taking it for granted because ultimately it can, that there is no reason to expect that the Democratic Party is capable of moving to the left?
I don't think that there is going to, that it is capable, because it's been, it is a neoliberal party. Certainly from, you know, I don't know from top to bottom, but certainly at the top, and, you know, spread through most of its elected figures, it's a neoliberal party. And they're not going to abandon their neoliberal positions. They're going to have to be forced out. I think that Sanders had the I wish that what he would have done was to go in with the attitude of burning down the house, you know, that it's just beyond salvation. It has to be burned down and it has to be completely rebuilt. To me, that was the only justification of an independent, a lifelong independent, running as a Democrat. And I think of Michelle Alexander. She wrote a very perceptive, the author of
The New Jim Crow.
She wrote a very perceptive piece, I think it was for the New York Review of Books, early on in the Sanders campaign, saying, look, the reason I can't support him is that he's running as a Democrat. And if you're choosing to run as a Democrat, you're almost by definition not a revolutionary. So this image that you're forging a revolution is an illusion to begin with. And, you know, we're at that point where maybe what we really need is a kind of political revolution for the left, and that maybe that revolution is the first step is just giving up on this party and forming something new.
But critics of that position would argue that Sanders would never have gained the prominence that he did had he not run within the Democratic Party. And was there a value to that? Was there a value to him galvanizing the support of especially younger people in seeing some kind of alternative to Clinton neoliberalism?
Well, I think that remains to be seen, doesn't it? It certainly, you know, there's been no evident political benefit out of it. I mean, as I write in the book, you know, he got these pledges in the platform, which were like written in disappearing ink. Yeah, they go into the platform and then, you know, the ink, you know, disappears and the platform's put in a vault somewhere and you never see it again. And in fact, all of these concessions that he supposedly got from Hillary, none of them resurfaced in her campaign. Economic inequality and economic justice weren't a part of her campaign. After Sanders, you know, made his détente with Hillary, even climate change as an issue disappeared from her prepared speeches. So this incredible movement that he built didn't show up, wasn't recognized by Hillary. And now, is it going to have an afterlife during Trump? You know, one can hope so, but if you have the same leadership of the Democratic Party in control, I don't see that it goes very far within the structure. Chuck Schumer is not going to lead any kind of raid on Wall Street. It's just not going to happen. And neither is, you know, Nancy, you know, $48 million net worth Pelosi. going to lead any kind of restructuring of the party that cuts her off from, you know, this corporate money that they've been dependent on for the past 25 years.
Well, you write extensively about the Democratic National Convention that took place in late July in the appropriately named Wells Fargo Center in Philadelphia. What do you think Sanders should have done then? I mean, you're saying that you feel like he should have burned the house down on his way out. What didn't happen that could have happened?
Yeah, I don't think he, by that point, I think he was boxed in. I think he could have stood up for, you know, some of his chief supporters, like, you know, Nina Turner, and, you know, demanded that she be given a speaking role at the convention. I thought that was just horrible on his part. I think his speech could have been, you know, much more a critique of the neoliberal drift of the party than it was. I don't think he had to, you know, essentially wipe out all of the votes of his supporters. I thought that was also a betrayal. But by the time you got to the convention, you know, the die was cast, and he was in a really difficult position that was of his own making. And, you know, that happened, you know, very early on, I think, in the primary campaign, when he made some very poor strategic decisions about how much he was going to attack Hillary frontally. I was very proud, though, of the Sandinistas. I mean, particularly, you know, I'm an Oregonian, and the Oregon, Washington, and I think, you know, some of the California delegation of booing Leon Panetta, you know, the drone czar. I thought that was fantastic, of walking out of the convention. I think that kind of energy showed great hope for the movement, because where their leader may have failed them, the energy of the movement survived that failure of leadership. And I think that is a really hopeful sign that something new may come out of this campaign and this failed revolution, as I call it.
Jeffrey Sinclair is my guest. He is the author of Bernie and the Sandinistas, co-editor of Counterpunch. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So turning our attention to the Sandinistas, what do we know of who they are, the basis of their support, to what degree they might be influenced by previous social movements like Occupy? Do we have enough data on who these people are?
I think that it's different regionally, but I do think that the basis of the movement comes out of Occupy and the $15 minimum wage movement. Those really coalesced around Sanders, and then you have your student movements as well. I mean, Bernie spent, you know, I sort of ridicule him for spending almost all of his time on college campuses. He did, you know, tend to gravitate there. I think that a lot of the energy from the movement was based on campuses. There were opportunities for him to broaden the movement he was speaking to, you know, 20,000 people in Boise, Idaho, and, you know, 15,000 people, you know, in Austin, Texas. And that's fine. But I thought that, you know, why not take a risk? And when you're in Las Vegas, go to Creech Air Force Base and join the anti-drone movement with a protest there. Why not, when you're in Texas, go to Huntsville and join the anti-death penalty protesters there? Why not show up at picket lines across the country to solidify your relationship? Well, certainly not the union brass, which were locked into the Hillary campaign, but with the rank and file. So I think those were these opportunities for him to sort of break out of this sort of student-based movement were there, and he didn't capitalize on them. You know, what you know, why not join, you know, with Black Lives Matter protesters, you know, on the streets of Cleveland or Baltimore or in Ferguson? Those are the kinds of things that we didn't see from Sanders. And I thought, I'm not that big of a Robert Kennedy fan. It'd be hard for most progressives, if you look too closely at his record, to be one. But when you looked at Kennedy's campaign in 68, you really saw him in urban America, in the poor parts of rural America, you know, in Appalachia. And I think that that was a model that Sanders could have used but didn't, because it was, you know, maybe you're not going to draw 20,000 people there, but you're certainly going to be, I think, broadening the base of your movement. And he failed at that. And I don't think he would have, you know, he would have won because the odds, you know, and certainly the superdelegates were stacked against him. But if your campaign was about building an enduring national political movement to counter neoliberalism, that's something that he could and perhaps should have done.
Well, thinking about the period we're going into right now, had Clinton been elected, one could imagine that people who had been galvanized by Sanders, the people you dubbed the Sandernistas, that they would have kept up their leftward criticism of Democratic Party neoliberalism into the presidency. But instead, we have Trump, and the Democrats have, for, well, as long as I can think, used the specter of a right-wing presidency as the reason to conform to the party line within the Democratic Party. Always the question of the lesser evil. For a lot of people, Trump would seem to be the greater evil that confirms that. Now, one could argue about that part, but are you concerned that in the Trump years ahead, that way of keeping people marching in line behind the Democratic Party is just going to be reinforced because it seems to be confirmation that the Republicans represent this greater evil and Clinton would be preferable, or anyone like Clinton, to a Trump, and hence there's no need for change, there's no need to do anything differently?
Well, that's exactly what we're seeing, right? I mean, and from, you know, progressive luminaries like Michael Moore, you know, now's the time not to, you know, self-critique. Now's the time to, you know, fight our Hitler in terms of Trump. And I think that's it's really the wrong approach. It's going to be it's going to prove, I think, disastrous for the progressive wing of the Democratic Party for, you know, or 8 years from now. You can look back because there's, you know, a historical record. It was the DLC, this corporate wing of the Democratic Party, grew in power under Reagan. And it, by the time, you know, the Clinton was running in 92, it kind of had a stranglehold on the party. Now, these trends started sort of much earlier. And then it, what I'm getting at is that a lot of these trends, which drove the rightward lurch of the Democratic Party, kind of happened under the radar. I mean, neoliberalism really, you know, got its, started germinating in the party during the Carter administration, and then sort of, you know, grew undetected during Reagan time because everybody was fighting, you know, Reagan, you know, James Watt, the wars in Central America, and what was happening to, you know, the Democratic Party largely went unnoticed. And I think we're going to see this repeated, and one of the things that's already happening is that money from the Democratic billionaire class is going to be funding the resistance.
So the Tom Steyers, the George Soroses, you know, the Warren Buffetts, all of this dark money is going to be controlling how the Democratic resistance to Trump behaves and how the party is structured for this battle that's going to take place over the next 2 and 4 years. And it's going to be a real challenge for the progressive resistance to separate itself and survive in this environment.
Well, let me end by asking you, on the one hand, clearly there are all these obstacles for the left, and you've indicated some of them. Looking ahead into the Trump era, what openings do you see?
Well, I think that the leadership vacuum in the party, and the fact that we've got these sort of, you know, these old known figures, creates an opportunity for the left that hasn't existed. And I believe firmly that, you know, our political movement should shouldn't follow trickle down politics on the progressive side. That things should come from the grassroots. And I think that these are going to be years of ferment. And I think that that's always good for building new movements and new leaders on the left. And there's a lot of breathing room, and there's a lot of opportunities for these new movements to grow. And my hope is that we'll see something like Jesse Jackson's old Rainbow Coalition of Black Lives Matter and the Chicano and Latino movements converging with the sort of the white-dominated Occupy movement. You know, the remainder of the Sandinistas joining forces with these other social movements that have really been abandoned by the Democratic Party. That's the hope.
You've written a lot about the environment. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about openings or places where you think that perhaps renewed social movements should focus their energies to do with protecting the environment, given the very naked politics of the Trump administration to be, which is dominated by executives from the fossil fuel industry.
I think one of the most hopeful things that has happened has been the Standing Rock protest. And, I mean, really out in the middle of nowhere to have thousands of people in the worst possible weather staying there, standing up, not being dislodged in the face of really brutal tactics. And that battle over a pipeline is one that can unify an entire swath of the country, right? It wasn't just protests going on in North Dakota. You had similar protests in Des Moines, Iowa, from the same pipeline. And it's those kind of struggles give the opportunity for really diverse movements to unify. I mean, my general view and critique of most social and political movements in the U.S. is that the farther away we get from the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, the more distant we are from the template that gave birth to the great political movements of the 60s and the 70s. The environmental movement, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, all of those were really based on the kind of organizing template that went into the civil rights movement. And I think that the Standing Rock protests have maybe given us at least part of a new template from which we can mount a broader resistance to the forces that are looming under Trump. And I do think that the environmental movement cuts across economic and racial lines. And nobody wants a pipeline, natural gas pipeline, or a crude oil pipeline, you know, threatening their water supply or, you know, potentially exploding in their neighborhoods. And those are the kind of movements that can really potentially take off and bring us together in ways that have a lot of possibility.
Well, on that hopeful note, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sasha.
I've been speaking with Jeffrey Sinclair. He's co-editor of Counterpunch and author of Bernie and the Sandinistas, Field Notes from a Failed Revolution, that's published by Counterpunch. And you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. His many books include the co-authored book Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.